because your light, O Lord, that we may see your eternal truth. And fill us with your love, that we may feel your presence amongst us always. And may we take those truths and love and share them with all of humankind. For in that day, there shall be peace and joy upon the earth. Amen. Comes again from Martin Luther King Jr. And this is a statement that I like a great deal because I think love is the answer, but we always have to keep filling out what that love means. And Martin Luther King Jr. said, "Love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend." I think that is very good and sound
advice. Did you get that? Yes. The second one comes to us from William Faulkner, a very well-known writer in American literature, who died at a rather young age. I think he was 62 or 63 when he died. And it's similar to that of Martin Luther King, but put in a different kind of linguistic form. And Faulkner advises us, "You cannot swim for new horizons until you have courage to lose sight of the shore. You cannot swim for new horizons until you have courage to lose sight of the shore." And so it is in our faith that we need to have the courage to take that principle of love and to take those ideas that are fundamental to the faith and many other faiths as well. And then with that courage, move forth and challenge the world around us, all of us, all over the world. And the third one is a quotation from Lao Tzu. He was born somewhere around the year 601 BC. He is the founder of a religion called Taoism. It's spelled with a T, but it's pronounced Taoism. Have you heard of Taoism? Yes, it's a Chinese religion, essentially. It was one of the two great religions in China alongside of Confucius. And it grew out of course, Buddhism. Lao Tzu wrote a text for that called the Tao Te Ching. And here in the United States, we're very familiar with that because in these modern days, particularly with young people and others, one of the favorite symbols is that round ball with the black and the white. That is the symbol of the Tao. And the harmony is what is the goal in that there. But Lao Tzu, or sometimes it's Lao Tzu with an E, being deeply loved by someone gives you strength, while loving someone deeply gives you courage. Again, some good advice. Being deeply loved by someone gives you strength. And that's really, I think, a fundamentally true statement about human beings. To feel love, to feel embraced, to feel that you are of value in the eyes of somebody else is most certainly uplifting for the person who is receiving that love. But loving someone deeply gives you courage. Because when you stretch out that love to somebody else, particularly if you are dialoguing with someone has entirely different kind of perceptions of that, it does take, it does give you a great deal of courage. So these three are my thoughts for the week this week. And they do in a very significant way tie in with what I want to talk about this morning for a few minutes in my sermon, which I've titled And sermon titles are, you know, rather, we were told in the seminar, you got to get something that's catchy. So I try to get something catchy, but then sometimes I wonder what I meant by it when I put it down. But not in this case. Are we locked in or are we open? And this comparison here talks about, at least from my point of view, those religious beliefs and those religions of all types who have their fundamentalistic kind of principles, and they think they really have it nailed down and will not move off from one side to the other. And we have lots of evidence of that in the biblical literature, as I'll try to explain here in a few moments. And people have very strong convictions about these things. I was telling some folks this morning, while we were sitting there, all five or six of us, and it was 9:10. Oh my goodness. Oh Lord, stop this snow. And I was telling them about my own personal experience as a young boy. I had a really good friend. We were friends from little kids all the way up. I used to go to his summer cabin with his family and so on. But he was a big fellow too. Lewis Nelson was his name. And he asked me to go with him one night to his church youth group. And I guess we were maybe 10 years old or whatever. And I said, sure. But the church that I was going to was the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. We didn't have any Wisconsin Synod churches around in Queens, although they might have it now. They've got everything under the sun. The borough of Queens is the largest population of diversity in the entire world. And they have over 2.4 million people in the borough of Queens. And Carolyn said to me this, well, I'm glad we don't live there anymore. Well, anyway, I went with him up to the Lutheran church. And we were going in the door, and we got to the door and went, and a man was standing there and said, who is this? And Lewis said, well, this is my friend, Bill. I said, does he go here? No. Well, then he can't come in. 10-year-old? Yeah, that really hurt. And my good friend said, well, I'll see you, Bill. And he went in. That was our end of friendship. I decided that if he did not have the courage to stand up for a friend, we were really good friends, and say, well, if he doesn't come in, I don't go in, or doesn't drag me by the arm in and say, what are you going to do about it now? And he didn't do any of that. And so that's what I'm talking about, these kinds of things. And it was not just the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church. The Wisconsin Synod's worse. Presbyterians have their own problems with that. And we have 8 or 9 different Presbyterian denominations to witness to it. The Orthodox Presbyterian Church, the Reformed Church, Presbyterian Church, the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church, the Cumberland Presbyterian Church, the Bible Presbyterian Church, and on it goes. And then those of us in the mainline Presbyterian Church say, we're the real Presbyterian Church. But we are not doing anything any better than they're doing. So on. So it's a difficult kind of thing. And these things ran across my mind as I was preparing this week. And these texts that we read for today, they are a marvelous kind of spread of different ideas. If you listen carefully to them as they were being read to us this morning, we have all four of them are different. Except for maybe the psalm. The psalm is a hymn or poem of thanksgiving. And that was a very positive kind of thing. It doesn't really stress action in this direction or that direction. But the other three do. If you read the text from Isaiah, Isaiah is a kind of text here, and this is at the end of the second Isaiah, because Isaiah can be divided into three sections. It kind of drips with joy. It kind of drips with welcomeness. it kind of drips with delight. You know, God is going to come and all of these things are going to happen and it's going to be a glorious day. And I'm going to make Jerusalem, you know, this is going to be the center of things. And it's very, very, very uplifting, this text from Isaiah. But if you look around in other parts of Isaiah, Isaiah is not so uplifting. I think, for example, of that famous suffering servant passage that we use a lot of times for communion, where Jesus looks back and he reads that section from Isaiah 52:13, where he's described as a man of sorrows and weeping, a man who is being despised and rejected, a man who is being turned down. Although, when it was originally written, it was not some kind of projection of the future. It was a description of the current status in Israel. But it has this kind of glorious thing, though, Isaiah. Now, fast forward to the Gospel of Luke. Now, Luke, of course, wrote not only the Gospel of Luke, but he is also considered to be the author of the book of the Acts of the Apostles. And the biblical scholars have wide general agreement on that. He begins that book by saying, "The former treatise I have given to you, O Theophilus." And he's going to pick up on what happens to the church now as it moves out into the world. Well, you know, when the church moved out into the world, the world wasn't sitting there saying, "Oh gosh, I am glad you're here now. I've been waiting for this all the time." Hardly. When the Christian faith moved out into the world, it ran into all kinds of difficulties. But Luke in this gospel kind of gives some hope for the future. He said, but he tells them, you know, don't expect when you go out and proclaim the faith or live the faith or try to live the faith that everything is going to be wonderful and hunky-dory and they will welcome you with open arms. Hardly the case. Let me give you a couple of examples from the early church. Not even the apostles and the early leaders of the church were exempt from being criticized and imprisoned and all kinds of things. There's a man by the name of Ignatius, who was bishop of Antioch. Now, don't get too carried away with the word bishop. It was not like, you know, the Archdiocese of New York. The bishop was basically the pastor of the community in that area, the leader of the community in that area. Well, Ignatius, he was a feisty son of a gun. And he would, told the Christians in there, you cannot offer sacrifices to the emperor. You cannot, you know, serve under them. You cannot give in to their demands. You can give in to those demands that are good for all people and support them. And he told the emperor, you know, the Christians are your best citizens. But the emperor writes back and said, no, you don't follow and offer worship to me or to our community. You are out. And he condemned him. And on his way to Rome to be executed, and he was executed, he lived from the year 75 to 110. On the way back, he wrote letters to the different churches that had been established, telling them his central beliefs about the Christian faith. And some of them today would be heretical, because none of that stuff was all worked out in those nice, fine theological systems that people like to have. But he's marching along, and he says, do not get in my way. I am going to Rome to die. And I am going to die for Jesus because I am committed to him. And he says, permit me to be an imitator of Jesus of Nazareth the Christ. And I remember reading that when I was working on my book. This guy was really crazy. I mean, he was just deliberately in the face of the Romans. And the Romans accommodated him. They executed him. But in the process, he took the gospel, proclaimed it in the culture of the day to challenge it, to change it, and to bring about a better society, and he would not back off of it. So that was his view of Jesus of Nazareth. And when they have these views of Jesus of Nazareth, in traditional theology, that's called Christology. And I remember saying, well, Ignatius of Antioch has a martyriological Christology. He is going to die, and he knows he's going to die, and he's going to live that because he believes that is the truth. And he did. Now, there's a second one who is involved in this as well, a man by the name of Justin the Martyr. You can see right away, you know, what happened to him. They didn't call him Justin the Martyr because he was Michael Milquetoast. What he did was he addressed the emperor and said to him, "You are supposed to be a great philosopher. Well, let's see what kind of a philosopher you are. And I will debate you on these things." And he did. And the Roman emperor said, "Well, you may philosophically debate with me, but I have the power." And with that power, he executed Justin. Unlike Ignatius, who went out with a kind of experiential kind of thing, Justin, who dealt with the philosophers of the day, was trying to bring it up to an intellectual level, and particularly since the emperor was supposed to be a great philosopher at the time. Now, this is an example of that kind of tension that we find in the Gospel of Luke. They are going to persecute you. They are going to be critical of you. They are going to be after you. They are going to knock you down. Of course, they were talking about the Roman Empire, but they were also talking about the Pharisees and the Sadducees and those who were making religious forms. You had to conform to that form. So it was in both directions that these people were addressing these issues. So lots of weeping was going on and lots of tragedy. Lots of false messiahs, Luke tells them, will be coming around. And you have to be wary of them, and you have to challenge them, and you have to engage them and show some courage, if you will. So Isaiah and Justin remind me always of the fact that people who have experienced Jesus of Nazareth and the love that comes through Jesus of Nazareth, the love of God, we are experiencing something that is very powerful and very gripping, and that does, in fact, have an impact upon the world. It was very, very small, a very small group of, how shall we say, critical Hebrews who were challenging that by focusing on the message of Jesus. A handful. Now, just to give you an idea, in the world today, there are over 2.4 billion Christians. It is the largest largest religious community in the world, followed secondly by Islam, which is about a billion short. That's kind of surprised me, particularly with all of the things that are going on in this modern world. And they put everything in this, when they're categorizing the religions of the world, and this group that took this task to heart. Humanists and atheists are also considered religions by this group. And they are about one half the number of the religious groups, particularly the Protestant and Catholic groups. So it's a faith that has grown immensely over the centuries, hasn't it? From a handful, well, from the 12 to 2.4 billion. And they project that by the year 2050, there will be even more, almost 3 or 4 billion Christians in the world. And they will still be the leading religious faith in the world society. So what does all this of this mean for us here? Well, this literature is sometimes called apocalyptic literature. It's a technical term that's used in theology, but it's a term that many people have understood. Apocalyptic literature is the kind of literature that deals with the end times, what's going to happen in the future. And they wrestle with that. And we can wrestle with that as a community, as a world, as a universe, and we also wrestle with it as individuals. I remember one time when I was first married, and Carol and I, much to the consternation of our pastor, we went and we worked for the Billy Graham New York Crusade in, I think it was 1957. And I remember him getting up there, and he was a marvelous speaker. He was not perfect like all of us, but one of the things that he that I admired about him was the fact that he would not preach at any service anywhere in the world that excluded anyone on the basis of color, on the basis of poverty, on the basis of who they were and what they were. Anyone who would be not welcome, then he would not welcome that place with his presence. And he did that. And it was, I think, a major step forward. Back in the 50s, where we got into this destruction or deconstruction of racism, which we still have in our society and have a long way to go. But he also made a statement one day. We had about, this was in the old Madison Square Garden on 8th Avenue and 53rd Street. I think it was 53rd Street. And he looked around, you know, was tiered for the New York Rangers hockey team. And he said, the end of the world is coming for at least 10% of you who are here tonight. You will have to face this. You know, and this apocalyptic literature, you know, can apply to you too here. We cannot shut people off. We have to have the courage to stand up and address those things that need to be addressed. And he did that with racism. And the church has done that with other things as well. Anti-war protests, economic protests, reaching out to people who need help to be lifted up out of the quagmire, so to speak. So this message, which started way back in that day, the day of Jesus, and we can see it's starting rather graphically with people like Ignatius and Justin Martyr and Philo of Alexandria and others. Is this a word to us? Yes. And sometimes it's hard to plug into that. I ask myself the question many times, why would anyone who lives in a fairly comfortable situation, I would look around this congregation here. We are all fundamentally comfortable. We don't have anybody sleeping in the street. We don't have anybody begging for food. We don't have anybody doing those kinds of things. You know, we're kind of in that class of comfortableness. And so why would anybody who is in that situation, why would we then bear witness to one who challenges and whose ways challenge all those things that we just kind of enjoy. Namely, why would we commit ourselves to Jesus of Nazareth? A very difficult kind of thing. Well, I have a couple of stories that will help us get over that, I think. There are two men that I'm going to refer to here. One man's name is Dr. Jeffrey Brenner. He's a medical doctor. He is a medical doctor who spent a great deal of his time working out in the community. He was from Camden, and he went back to Camden, and he developed a community of believers and workers in Camden that went out and addressed all of the homeless, went out and addressed those who had no funds, had no food, had no place to put their heads. And he said, I have a quotation from him here that I think is pretty interesting. He wrote a book, he had this community that he called a federation to address the community. And he makes the following comment. As a society, we've effectively decided that people shouldn't die on the streets, but it is acceptable for them to live there. And a statistic I heard on the radio this week, there are more than 500 million people living on the streets. And Dr. Brenner is trying to address that in Camden. Yes, you can get a bed, and you can get some medical help, because theoretically, at least, when you go to the hospital, they have to treat you if you have money or not. But to give them, and they can get maybe a meal there and a bed for a night. But we do nothing, or very little, about finding how can we address this problem. And if we address the problem wholeheartedly, totally, human beings have great imagination for doing things. It's not something that we could not do. It's something that we choose not to do because most of the time we don't even see it. But if you go through some subsections of big cities, you'll see it in a hurry. I remember getting lost in the south side of Chicago. That was not a pleasant experience, and so on. So we're part of this story, and it's a challenging story. It's not an easy story. It is one that is difficult to deal with. The other fellow is... his name here, Patrick. Well, we had a different difficulty with his last name. I don't know how to pronounce it. Not this hard to pronounce, but there are probably four or five different ways of pronouncing it. His name is Dr. Patrick. He's also he's not a medical doctor. He's a practical theologian, which means you take the theories of religion and put them into practice. He wrote a book in 2016, and the book title is Nobody Cries When We Die: God, Community, and Surviving to Adulthood. He is, his name is Patrick, I say Rise, and I say Rise because you spell it R-E-Y-E-S. Take the R off and it's eyes, so I say Rise. Others say no, say it's reason. And there are lots of different. That doesn't really matter. What he wrote is what matters. He was a Latino. And he said he had all kinds of difficulties growing up. He was shut out here and shut out there. But he fought it and got through. And he is working very diligently with people in this federated community to address that that program. To get people education, to get people an opportunity to move forward. And he does a very, very good thing. And one of the things he argues in is, he says, think of the good that all of this will do if you get engaged in it. You will be helping to exercise God's justice to the world. You will be helping God's love to be expressed in the world. That doesn't mean you have to run out and you know, be persecuted. But we should be going out and doing some good things. And we do good things. But we need to do more. Because 500,000 homeless people in, theoretically, at least the richest country in the world, that doesn't seem to fit together. And he is driving this directly toward people of color, or people who are minorities in society, to help them get lifted up into the world. And it's a difficult thing to do. He is presently director of the Strategic Partnerships for Doctoral Initiatives for the Forum for Theological Exploration. And that whole program is to support the minorities who get shut out. So it's another thing, you know. But many of us, myself included, we find comfort within the system. And if you don't fit in our system, then you're out. We close the door on you because you don't think like we do, instead of opening it and having conversations back and forth. That's why during my entire academic career, I went to the national and regional meetings for the Society of Philosophy. There was a society for Christian philosophy, and I occasionally went to that also. But that would be like going and talking to the converted. But you go where the opposition is and have a real dialogue. That's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. And we can make progress on both sides, perhaps. I know people who are critical of the religious faith love to pick out our ancient doctrines. Of course, that's easy to do. But they do not actually contextualize them and contextualize them today because they are not exactly the same at all. But then I guess I ask myself the question, why would I want to witness again to one whose ways will only be difficult for me? It's an important question, and so on. And that brings us to the third letter, New Testament lesson, the Thessalonians. Now, you know the Thessalonians was the first, Thessalonians was the first of Paul's letters. And he went and said, and they were sitting around waiting, and they were waiting for Jesus to come back again. Because this apocalyptic literature talks not only about his death, but also about his return. And we have to work in between time to establish that love. But the Thessalonians were not very good at it. They had their own little thing, and they would follow anybody who would be doing what they want. And Paul's advice to them at the very end was, never mind all of that. Never mind worrying about when this is happening. Get to work, and get to work now, as we have tried to demonstrate to you when we were amongst you. And that is our task today. And then when the end comes, it will come when it's supposed to come. And do not be overly concerned with that, but do the good. Do not get weary in well-doing. Very practical advice. In the letter, both letters to the Thessalonians. And practical advice and good advice for us here today. So, are we locked in? In other words, do we have our systems of doctrine and our view of the scriptures? And that is it? When the ink dries on the page, it's over? Or are they living documents? That when they are presented in every situation down through history, you run into different kinds of issues. And that goodness has to take on new forms and new shapes. And if you look at it historically, it has done that. But we still have a long, long way to go. So I kind of use this as a summation of the ordinary year in the Christian calendar. Because in 2 weeks we will start Advent. And Advent is the Christian calendar, which is really very short, from Advent to the Pentecost. And then you have that big long gap in between. And focusing on Advent, which really means new beginnings, a new start, a new opening. And that has been the philosophy of the Christian faith ever since it was initiated by Jesus of Nazareth, when he said, the old, no, this is the new. All people are open and welcome in my house and in God's house. So let's think on those things as we close out the calendar religious year and prepare for the Christian calendar that begins with Advent. And they are joyful. They all challenge us to be better people.